Hello, you're listening to Playback Daily. It's Tuesday, the 25th of March. I'm Louise Herity, and from dry stone walling to spirals in the sky, here's just some of what's coming up on the show.
But then it's when he said, and of course you'll want to find out if it has spread, that the penny really dropped as to how serious cancer can be and what it means.
And so I'm retired now, and I do a small bit of farming. And I just find it fascinating that the stones that we are lifting today was lifted many hundreds of thousands of years ago. And, you know, it's part of our heritage and we should look after it.
But you know, when you break up with someone and, you know, if you've been with someone for a long time, you get custody of various friends. And that can be very sad as well.
On the business news with Adam Maguire this morning on Morning Ireland, we heard about US firm 23andMe entering bankruptcy protection and what the impact might be for anyone who has used it.
Yesterday, US firm 23andMe entered bankruptcy protection. It was part of a wave of genetic testing services once valued at $6 billion. Now it's going to seek to sell itself with a price tag likely to be below $50 million. And the jewel in the crown is sure to be the database of millions of users' personal information, including their DNA. But what are the privacy implications of this? To help find out, we're joined on the line by Dara O'Brien, CEO of data consultancy firm Castlebridge. Dara, a year ago, 23andMe said it had genotyped 14 million people worldwide. We don't know how many of those are Irish. The tests, though, still are for sale at the moment on their website this morning. Should people who use the service be worried at this stage?
Yes, is the short answer. Not only people who use the tests, but anyone who's related to them or might in the future be related to them by blood, because it's genetic data. One of the key issues here is that when 23andMe is sold to whoever buys them, there is no guarantee that any of the privacy protections that they purport to have will carry over under the new contract. And you've no idea what will happen to your data at that point. So in that context, the data they have is quite sensitive, potentially, and can identify relationships between people and can identify likelihood of having particular medical conditions and things like that.
Now, whatever about the protections that the company might have promised, there would have been obligations at a European level in terms of data protection. They tend to be better than the US. But given that this is a US sale and it's a US company, will anything that Europe has in terms of its rules and obligations count in all of this?
Well, because 23andMe was a US company targeting people in the EU, GDPR does apply to them, and they do have a European-nominated representative. The difficulty is that when we go to try and exercise our rights at this point against 23andMe, it could get complicated because they're going to have a tsunami of deletion requests from people looking to delete all their data. And if they don't act or respond on that, European regulators will have to enforce against them. The difficulty there is it's all tied up in the EU-US transatlantic data privacy framework. Apologies to everyone for having nerd talk over your cornflakes. But that's basically the agreement between the European Union and the US around mutual enforcement of data protection rules to allow transfer of data. The fundamentals of that agreement have been undermined by the Trump administration, and the Trump administration has been quite hostile in recent weeks to the concept of European regulation on US companies. So the practical challenges of actually enforcing against 23andMe or any successor, if data isn't handled correctly in line with EU law, are potentially significant.
So do Irish consumers have any protection here or any realistic hope that they might be able to get their data deleted or protected in some way?
Well, you can go to 23andMe and delete your data if you have used 23andMe. The issue there is 23andMe's privacy policies are quite clear that there are circumstances where they won't delete your data or they will retain certain data for various legal obligations. And one of those legal obligations might now be argued not reducing the value of the asset they have, which is the data. The other complicating factor is they have shared anonymized data, so not linked to directly identifiable personal information, with partners. But your DNA is out in the world there with partners and researchers who may have had that data shared with them. And it mightn't be particularly easy to track that down and have that deleted. The other complicating factor in this is that if my cousin has done a 23andMe test, my data, my DNA is held by 23andMe, but there is no direct link to me to that data in their database for me to be able to make a request to have that data deleted. So DNA data is a complicated minefield when private companies are handling it.
Another reason why people should be extra vigilant in terms of what data they're handing over to people. Dara O'Brien, CEO of data consultancy firm Castlebridge, thank you very much for that.
And that was Adam Maguire from RTE's business desk on Morning Ireland. Later, we got Oliver Callan's take on the story.
Anyway, be careful what you do with your data and your DNA, because today a DNA testing company in the United States has gone bankrupt. Now, the problem here is its customers are 15 million people who have sent their genetic information, saliva samples essentially, in the post, which contain their family and personal health history. The company's gone bankrupt, which means that DNA, the data, is up for sale. And some of the customers, mostly American, but some of the customers are in Ireland, because 23andMe sold saliva test kits here and store them and linked up to what they purported to be your ancestors and so on. The company is named after the 23 chromosome pairs that make up the human genome, and they provide the saliva-based test kits to customers to help them track their ancestry. Now, there are scientific limitations about this, and genetics people say they're not testing your ancestry at all. It's problematic because it infers that you've got this, your individual's ancestry. But of course, the genetic information is very limited because it's only based on living populations. And it depends where the company is based, because the databases will be skewed towards different parts of the world. So they're connecting people to people. And it's problematic, to say the least. What happened here is interesting, because 23andMe is one of these companies that had a lot of issues. There was a data breach in 2023. Hackers appeared to target Jewish and Chinese customers, gained access to personal information from nearly 7 million profiles. This company is valued $6 billion a couple of years ago, which just shows the strength of the market of these ancestry DNA databases online. And it was traded from $6 billion to 50 million last week before the bankruptcy filing, because people just didn't have faith in how their data was being stored after the data breach and so on. So there's now a risk that your data, if you sent it to 23andMe, could get sold or transferred to a new company which might want to use it for new purposes. Of course, this is happening anyway, even in the companies that are doing very well. They've been selling to pharmaceutical companies who are very interested in your saliva, to say the least. A privacy is power advocate, Professor Carissa Veliz, said this is arguably the most valuable personal data that you have. If you gave your data to 23andMe, you gave them the genetic data of your parents, your siblings, your children, and even distant kin who did not consent to that or even know that it's happened. Make you delighted for yourself. Just let the advice is just be an a Cormac Arfad indeed.
And later on the show, Oliver was joined in studio by author Roisin Lanigan about her latest novel, a ghost story set in the rental crisis. I want to go home, but I'm already there.
Set the scene for us for the opening of this book and where Anya and her boyfriend finds herself.
So she begins the book living with her best friend, Laura. That kind of part of your 20s or 30s where you're living with your friends. Her best friend decides to move in with her boyfriend, and they get this houseboat that they're renovating. And so Anya has to move in with her boyfriend, and she has no reason not to because they're supposedly very in love. So they find this flat which is under asking price and in this lovely area, and yeah, she's immediately suspicious of this. And she spends the whole tenancy, so the book is sort of told over the course of their tenancy, thinking that something is very wrong, that there's something supernaturally wrong with the house, and Elliot's not so convinced. And it charts their relationship, the tension in their relationship, and also like with the landlord over the course of this year.
And what's going on in Anya's life that she's sort of feeling smothered by this house?
I think that she's just, it's kind of, someone described it recently as her Saturn return, which I think is like an interesting way of describing it. She's in this second adolescence where she feels she has to grow up, and the relationship isn't perfect and the house isn't perfect. And Anya is someone that thinks that these things should be perfect for her to, you know, put her whole weight behind them. And she, I think that there are a lot of like material problems in her life that she then transposes onto supernatural. But maybe there is a ghost, you know.
Maybe there is.
It's up to people to decide.
I could barely figure it out. I was halfway through and it's kind of going, I'm starting to lose my mind slightly as well. And your idea of the haunted house story, you were listening to kind of a podcast, and you had a kind of a dawning, didn't you, what haunted houses stories are all about?
Well, I was listening to, I don't know if you've sort of aware of this like recontextualization of like Amityville, which is, you know, this hugely
famous
lucrative,
haunted
house. And people saying now that perhaps that wasn't a haunt, and perhaps it was more to do with this family put all their investment into this huge house. And they were a Catholic family, so it was very difficult for them to get divorced and move away. They were tied to this house, and the fact that it was haunted allowed them to leave it and also freed them up financially to talk about that experience. And it made me think that like haunted house stories are just about finance. They're about owning property, essentially, and being tied to property.
Zombie capitalism.
Exactly, yeah.
Basically zombie. And that's the feeling that goes through it. But it also works as a ghost story as well. So you obviously you must love scary stories.
I do, yeah. I love like haunted house stories and like scary movies and stuff like that. And, you know, I watched The Haunting of Hill House on Netflix. I love that.
That's great.
I thought that was brilliant. So I'm interested in that genre, but I wanted to like turn it on its head. There's some things that I don't like in horror. I don't like how women are depicted in horror, and I wanted Anya to be sort of a rebuke of those kinds
of women.
That's
got much better though, hasn't it?
It has got better, but I think particularly in haunted house, like even in things like Hereditary, which is like a modern haunting,
the
mother is still very, very put upon and martyred and ignored by her son and her husband and those kinds of things. So I think that women often occupy that space in a haunted house.
I suppose I was thinking about the Invisible Man with Elizabeth Moss. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I really love that.
That's incredible.
That was great.
Yes, and it's got a kind of scary house in the beginning. Beautiful house.
Exactly.
But it's like, it's a prison. And good ending.
Much like this one.
Good ending. Yeah. Jumping back, because there's people coming in, the landlords are complaining already, bad tenants and so on. You've had a rough time as a renter, though.
I've had a good time and a bad time as a renter, but I think that it's more the lack of choice that annoys me. And the fact that having a good time as a renter is still... it's still not on a level playing field. Like, I couldn't just decide to... I couldn't ever go to my landlord and be like, oh, you know, me and you have a good friendship here. Could you knock £400 off? I know you're not paying as much as I'm paying you. So I've had very nice landlords. I've had awful landlords. I think the ubiquity of the landlord is the thing that is annoying. Like, it's a hamster wheel. You can't escape it. My generation will always experience that. You can't get out of the housing crisis because no one is selling or buying their houses.
Yeah. And obviously you can't save because your rent, the most of it is going on.
And that's what's frustrating as well, is you go to a mortgage advisor and they say, well, like, oh, you don't have enough savings and you don't earn enough to buy a house. But often your mortgage payments would be the same as your rent payments. And you know that because your landlord is telling you that.
But I suppose because the horror stories you've experienced have informed this novel, I mean, it's a damp flat they go into, and then of course they're accused of a letting agent of making the flat damp and giving instructions about lids
very,
on.
Very common. I've definitely heard that, like, oh, it's because you don't put the lids on when you're cooking your pasta. It's just maddening. Like.
And I have also heard from landlords saying that tenants will block up the vents that make the house breathe.
Because it's cold.
Because there's a draft.
Yeah.
But also the draft is the thing keeping the house free.
Yes,
Two sides. how bad was it for you? Did you had bed bugs at one stage?
I had bed bugs twice. I had bed bugs when I first moved to London, within like the first week of moving there, and had to just throw out all my stuff, which was brilliant. And then moved to like a flat up the same street, and it was like an agency flat. I just sort of walked in off Bethnal Green High Street and gave someone, you know, a couple of £1,000, and they put me in this flat for the next year. I've had damp. I've had landlords. One landlord, her dad kept calling up the flat and saying, you know, she's really upset, she's crying all the time. It's just
the banshee.
Just bizarre experiences where I was just like, well, I don't know what to tell you for that. And I've also had landlords who've been very, very nice, but they are still landlords at the end of the day.
You have it in. You're not going to win them over, that's for sure. And in the story, we see the cracks developing in this relationship. So it has a kind of horror story element to it, and it also has this relationship thing. Is that very important now of the Gen Z millennial novel?
I think so. And I think that relationships don't break down on their own. And I think that like these precarious living situations do feed into that. And people moving in together quicker than perhaps they should, or staying together for longer. Or something that's common now is you have maybe like two or three or four couples living in the one house because it's like cheaper to you have a room each, and that puts pressure on relationships. So I do think the housing crisis has made millennial love and romance and Gen Z love and romance a very different experience to previous generations.
And you were getting married when you started writing the book?
I was getting married when I wrote the book, and I am now divorced. But it wasn't a ghost, it was just...
Just didn't work out.
Because
you're very young, and obviously that's a sad story itself.
It is, but I think that like that's like, as I say, that millennial and Gen Z love and relationships and expectations of it has changed. I think that the rise in young divorces is a part of that. So I remember when I was getting divorced, seeing ads on the tube quite often for apps that you could use to help, like, to hire divorce lawyers.
Really?
And it was funny because they were aimed at, to me, divorce was like a thing that happened to older people, but these apps were like, help your son get through his divorce. So I think it was possibly the influx of post-pandemic breakups, and
I see.
Everything was much more like Hingeified in terms of
divorce. So you were married for just a year, was it?
Yes, just a year.
Was it British law divorce, or was it quick to get divorced?
I think it was a year, yeah, that you could get divorced. And I think it's different here. 2 years?
Yes, you have to be living apart for at least 2 years before you can even begin the process.
I mean, that's
don't get into the expense.
Crazy.
Was it expensive, by the way? Is it
in the UK, you can have no fault divorces. So if you don't have like existing property or anything that you share, which I did not, it's fairly easy, and it's all done via HMRC. I mean, I say easy, it's, you know, a difficult experience, which is why I wrote about it. I wrote about it for The Fence, like did an essay on that, and kind of this idea of like cultural young divorces.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it would be very more difficult if you had to break up for a year and live separately and divide all your assets up, that kind of thing.
And how are you now with that?
Oh yeah, I'm grand now. Yeah.
Like more than grand, are you kind of doing, giving us a Belfast, I'm grand?
No, genuinely I'm grand. It's it's one of those experiences that, like, I didn't expect that essay to sort of have the wherewithal that it did. I think I just wrote it, thought no one would read it, and then everyone read it.
It
I was
really
like, oh,
did.
Brilliant, yeah. Here we go.
I think it's unusual, particularly over here, because I think the average age for getting married in the first place is late 30s at this stage, 37.
Well, I think people do get married later because they... I've said this as well, it's like people get married later and have children later because where are they going to put these children? Like, where are they going to live when they get married? They can't buy a house.
Yeah, the pressures that are there.
Yeah.
The other type of breakup is, of course, when friendships end.
Yeah.
And there's one of these in this novel. It's another housing related horror, isn't it? Just it is that separation where someone suddenly can afford their house and the other can't.
Or even just decides that they've moved on from that part of their life. And I think that, like, Laura and Anya, the best friend that she sort of breaks up with, I think that that's like the love story of the book more than Anya and her boyfriend Elliot, because friendship breakups I think can be more devastating than relationship breakups, because when someone, you know, as you've just done, when someone has a relationship breakup, you go like, and you're well now and everything's good, but you don't ever do that when someone breaks up with
that's
a friend.
Right, you don't.
You just sort of go like, oh, okay, well, that's sad, and you just move on. And it can be as devastating. These are very intimate relationships and they define a part of your life. And to move on from that in quite a broken way is really devastating.
And there's no separation process. So sometimes it can be a very blunt guillotine.
Yeah.
It's done. Over.
Like, well, you know, when you break up with someone and, you know, if you've been with someone for a long time, you get custody of various friends. And that can be very sad as well. So I think it's like it plays into all those kinds of things. And with female relationships as well, sometimes you can have what Laura has, which is you replace the intimate relationships that you have through friendships with a partner. And that part of your life just sort of dies away, which is very sad, I think.
So Anya loses Laura and Laura goes off into a houseboat with her American fiancé.
Yeah, which is a weird thing, that the houseboat phenomenon. I think it is, like, there was this chat a while ago that it was a way of like hacking the property market, because you could buy a houseboat for maybe like 30 grand and do it up, and then that could be your first house. And it's like, well, you still are living on a boat, like it's just so aware.
Surrounded by freezing water.
There's no Wi-Fi and you've got to move it every 2 weeks or something.
And doing it up, which is what Laura proceeds to do, and that's how she becomes the influencer.
Yes, she does.
You have a wry look at her.
Author Roisin Lanigan chatting to Oliver Callan, and you can hear the interview in full on the RTE Radio app. Irish author Anne Enright has been awarded the prestigious Wyndham Campbell Prize, as Maggie Doyle told us on Morning Ireland.
Author of 8 novels and 2 short story collections, she won the Booker Prize in 2007 for The Gathering, and her 2015 novel, The Green Road, won Irish Novel of the Year and was shortlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction. In a video shared on the awards website last night, Anne Enright described her approach to fiction.
I think every time you're writing a book, you're playing with elements of your own psyche. It must be you in some form, some shadow self or some projected self. In The Green Road, I could tell you where things came from. The window and the angle of the light in April came from the house where I grew up. We didn't sit around the table like that, but for a writer, you move to an adjacent kind of reality. You don't move very far. But you have to move far enough to enable fiction to happen.
Anne Enright speaking after winning the Wyndham Campbell Prize. More on that in a moment. It's a good day too for Paul Lynch and his novel Prophet Song. He's been shortlisted for the Dublin Literary Award, which at €100,000 is the most valuable prize for a single work. It previously won the Booker Prize in 2023. And Anne Enright herself also won the Booker back in 2007 for The Gathering. Our arts and media correspondent Evelyn O'Rourke joins us now. Evelyn, it's difficult to get through all those prize winning authors, isn't it? I mean, it's fantastic news this morning. Tell us a little bit about what Anne Enright has won. What is the Wyndham Campbell Prize?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Maggie. I mean, we don't like to talk about money in the arts world, you know what I mean? You know, it's about the writing, it's about the work, but look, you'd have to be forgiven to be overexcited. I mean, these are extraordinary prizes with really amazing funding. And I suppose the point of this, and we'll come to this now, the Wyndham Campbell Prize, the idea behind this prize in particular was to give money to writers, to give them financial security and freedom. So the idea is maybe emerging writers, that they get writing or recognise the body of work to allow them to focus fully on their creativity. And that's the joy and the power, really, of that story. An amazing story established in 2013 for the American novelist Donald Wyndham in memory of his partner's 40-year Sandy Campbell. And the idea is they nominate 8 writers every year. And Enright is actually the recipient, the 8th Irish recipient of this, the 7th woman writer, previous winners including, for example, Marina Card, the playwright. But that's the idea. They get this unrestricted grant of $175,000, and they're open to, the prize is open to English language writers at all stages of their career, and they get 60 new nominators every year. They then invite and make 2 nominations each. It's a fascinating process, all a bit cloak and dagger. Nominators are asked not to communicate with writers during the process, so you don't really know until the end, until you get that magical contact to say yes, that you are one of the 8 winners of this year's Wyndham Campbell Prize.
And what has Anne Enright said about her fantastic win?
Well, look, what's brilliant about Anne is that she's always very funny and very entertaining when she wins these kind of awards. You're always watching out for the quote, you know. So she's brutally honest. I mean, as you heard her there, she's talking, she's just so delighted by it. The work was described by the judging panel, her work is formidable and to nothing short of momentous. And she's talked about the fact that really the sense of unreality of winning this has been amazing. It's been, she says, an astonishing thing to drop out of a clear blue sky. And really she summed it up by saying, I'm floored by the generosity and the goodwill. And that really speaks to the spirit of this award, that it's about that generosity and goodwill, that you get this money that you can then go and focus on your writing, and you're getting this incredible acclaim and support to focus on that very important literary work. So really she's it's a great answer. She's just a wonderful recipient for this, and people across all her fans across the country will be so thrilled to see that recognition for her.
And Evelyn, good news too for Paul Lynch. He's one of 6 authors nominated for the very lucrative Dublin Literary Award for his novel Prophet Song.
I know, again, I mean, Paul Lynch would be absolutely delighted with this. He won the Booker last year with Prophet Song. He joined 6 writers. In this case, the books also recognise books in translation. So that €100,000, if it's that case, which it was, for example, last year, the winning the prize pot is divided between the writer and the translator. So just the 6 writers very quickly, Selva Almada for Not a River, Gerda Blies for We Are Light, Michael Crummy for The Adversary, Percival Everett for James, Paul Lynch, indeed, our Irish writer there for Prophet Song, and Daniel Mason for North Woods. And this prize, which is sponsored by Dublin City Council, will be announced on May the 22nd. We just have a little flavour of Paul Lynch's own reaction to being shortlisted. And he talks about the importance of libraries, Maggie. And you know, I think that's really powerful at that prize, with the Dublin Literary Prize, because we know that the nominees here are the librarians across the world. So they're the people really dealing with what readers, what the regular fans.
The Dublin Literary Award, it's one of the great prizes, unique for the fact that it has global reach, and so is inclusive of writers in translation. The prize has introduced me as a reader over the years to many wonderful writers, both in English and in translation. And it's good to be reminded that there are writers we should read who are not writing directly into English. The award is unique too for its nomination process, in that it is driven by libraries and librarians worldwide. And the importance of libraries seems very obvious to me. I believe you can judge the quality of a culture by how well supported its libraries are.
Author Paul Lynch there, and before that, RTE Arts and Media correspondent Evelyn O'Rourke on Morning Ireland. While many of us would find it hard to come to terms with using more than one language, Claire Byrne's guest has studied over 50. Richard Simcott is one of the UK's most multilingual people.
Good morning, Claire.
Thank you for being with us. You've been described as one of the UK's most multilingual people, and having studied up to 50 languages is a lot by anyone's standards, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's obviously, you know, when you come to studying things in depth and going into so much detail with a number of languages, the numbers don't mean so much. Really, what we're talking about is languages that are often very much related. So languages from the same families, you know, the Romance languages, the Germanic languages, and the Slavic languages have really been my main focus. But once you've added those together, you're already pushing quite high numbers before you even start looking at any languages outside of that.
So listen, of the 50 languages then, I've read you say that you use about 15 regularly and 30 then over the course of a year. Is that still the case?
Yeah, roughly. I mean, it's not, you know, exactly mathematics when it comes to this kind of thing, but yeah, roughly. I mean, I grew up speaking English, obviously, at home, but then later when I was older and I'd been through university and married my wife and I speak Macedonian together, for example. And then with my daughter, I grew up with her speaking, she grew up, sorry, speaking French, German, Spanish with me as well. So we had a multilingual household. And then outside the house in Skopje, we would always use Turkish, Albanian. And then we'd go to Greece quite often, speak Greek. And in Bulgaria, I'd switch over to Bulgarian and Serbia to Serbian. So very quickly, these numbers sort of rack up. And then you'd have sort of work-related languages like your German, French, Scandinavian languages, other Slavic languages like Polish or Czech, whatever, where I need to use, whether it was just for reading or for using to speak to people, however that was, I would be using quite a number over the course of a year.
And how hard is the switch? You know, when you're having to switch between those languages, what's it like?
Yeah, it's a very interesting thing, actually. I really cut my teeth on the whole switching thing when I was working in customer services and technical support many, many years ago after university. I was taking calls in around 8 languages regularly, and the phone would come up and it would say Switzerland, and I'd have to guess which language it would be. So I'd say something, you know, I'd say bonjour, or I'd say guten Tag, or whatever. And you could almost guarantee that it was going to be the wrong one, and an Italian voice would pop up, and I'd have to switch immediately into the other language. Or it would say Italy, for example, and everyone expects it to be Italian, right?
Yes.
But no. Sometimes you get a call from Italy and you've got the Italian code, and then they say Grüß Gott in German, which is hello, because it's calling from South Tyrol.
So you're making your adjustment pretty quickly in those instances.
Yeah.
So then, I mean, as I said at the beginning, I mean, what we really wanted to talk to you is about those high level interpretation, interpreter jobs, where there is so much at stake and you absolutely have to get it right. I mean, the pressure must be immense.
Oh, yeah, the pressure is, for those people, absolutely enormous. I mean, you're talking about things that you see in the news happening. So you're very aware of, you know, the wrong word or the wrong reaction or the wrong way of phrasing something could become an international incident, and people's lives sometimes are in the balance when you have that kind of issue. So yeah, I mean, it's extremely high pressured and not something that I think any of the interpreters that do that kind of job take lightly, but it's not always in their hands either, because it depends on whether or not note takers are allowed, whether they then use the notes to then go back, depends on the setup. So every leader will also have their own preferences as to how they use these. The interpreter's job really is to represent faithfully what's being said in the room.
And if you're translating something, is your job to translate word for word, or do you have to do a bit of a cultural nuance translation as well, Richard?
Well, I mean, you know, if we take a thing like, you know, Irish and English, I mean, you get these turns of phrase that are used in Ireland so that you wouldn't use in, say, the UK, you know, with, you know, what kind of thing someone's got on them or at them. And they're things that are from the Irish language translated into Hiberno English, but can only really be understood fully in the context of Irish English. Well, if you imagine that, you know, 10 times more over an international sort of where people don't have that access to the cultural or other linguistic links, it makes it even more complicated. So a direct translation won't always work. And also the cultural reference points won't always work because what's said in one context might not be something that's said in another.
And if I'm sitting in a room and I'm the interpreter for somebody who's sitting beside me and someone on a video link says something that is very offensive, are you prepared to translate that directly, even though the person who's being insulted is sitting right beside you. You have to, I suppose, don't you?
Well, yeah, I mean, they have to represent faithfully what's being said. I mean, you know, there's one thing to make slight adjustments to allow the message to still be given without it being completely garbled because of cultural or linguistic issues, because of the way the message is phrased. But it's a completely different thing to change the message entirely. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, if something's being said, that's the message. And yeah, whether it's nice or not, interpreters will have to do that. And, you know, you can imagine during the Cold War, during trips to China with the Reagan administration and the Nixon administration, they've had teams of interpreters so that they don't have to rely just on one person, them getting tired, them getting stressed, them getting just, you know, too heavily put on.
So how do you feel then about us mere mortals when it comes to linguistics, learning a language on the apps? There are lots of new ones out at the moment. Do they work, do you think?
I think there's only one thing that really works, and that's a desire to learn and to allow that language to become part of your life. I mean, if you are just relying on a couple of hours a week, unfortunately, it's not going to cut it in a very short time. In the longer term, maybe you might edge your way forward in the language, but it's going to be quite slow progress, and the chances are that you're going to give up at some point. Whereas if you are able to actually, you know, give yourself realistic goals and set yourself a realistic amount of time to be able to achieve those goals, then you're going to have success. It's usually having contact with the language, I would say, on a daily basis if you want the best results.
Mm-hmm. And you gave Irish a go during lockdown. How was that?
I have. Tomia Folam Gilga Nish.
Very good.
My Tarsha Ru Yakker.
My gosh, you got an accent there and everything, Richard. It's going very well.
Yeah, Tommy Mahoney in Skopje Nish, I guess. Haniel, yeah, Gilga and Valia, sure.
That's amazing. Yeah. In comparison to the other languages you've studied, what was Irish like?
It's tough because, as I say, you know, you can't really use it so much here in the Balkans, as you can imagine. But I absolutely love it. I mean, at the moment, my Irish is getting a little bit mixed up with my Scottish Gaelic because I've been kind of fluctuating between the two and enjoying both. Mm-hmm. But my focus has been until this year on Cornish. And so I sat all of the Cornish exams and I finished that. And now I sit on the terminology panel for the Cornish language and absolutely love it. But yeah, Celtic languages are my kind of new focus. They were my plan for my retirement, but COVID happened and I was like, okay, why not start now?
Yeah, it's just an extraordinary thing to be so proficient at and so interested in. I mean, have there been any studies? Have you found anything to explain why you're the person who can learn 50 languages?
I think it's the same thing because, you know, people you get at home who love football or love any sport and they're able to memorize all of the, you know, the league tables, the different names of the clubs, the different players for each club. And they know all of this at such a level because they're genuinely interested in it. Mm-hmm. They see the world through the context of what they're interested in. For me, that's language. So, you know, when I see the name of a place, like I see Derry and then I say Dora in Irish, and then I learned that word actually is like oak forest, and that's where the word Derry comes from. And then I'll learn that in Cornish, Derio is the word for oaks as well, oak trees. So you see this link, this common Celtic link, and this is how my brain sort of goes out really from there. Everything I look at, I see in the context of how it links together the bridges that we have between the languages and the cultures and people, and how it really adds colour to our world.
Richard, it's been fascinating to talk to you. Thank you so much. Richard Simcott there. Gurv Mila Mahagot, agus slánga fóil, Richard.
Oh, Gurv Mahagot, slánga fóil.
Richard Simcott on Today with Claire Byrne. Some people looking at the sky last night, especially in the southeast, noticed a large glowing spiral. And David Moore from Astronomy Ireland joined Oliver Callan to explain what it was.
Good morning, Oliver.
First of all, can you describe, I know you're not a novelist or anything, but what that swirl looked like to people who saw it last night?
Yes, I've never seen one myself.
Oh.
We have had Irish reports in the past, but people saw them. We had only two reports from Waterford I was looking at the sky quite often last night. It was mostly cloudy over the whole country. I'm surprised it was even clear over Waterford. But they have fantastic views over Britain, where it really went viral. Yeah. And would have been seen over Ireland if we had one of those rare, clear skies. But it looks like a big spiral in the sky. And it's actually rocket fuel being vented by a spacecraft that was launched earlier.
That's still pretty cool. And what exactly is
happening? Oh, yeah, I mean, an amazing sight, yeah.
What has happened to it? Why is it making that swirling vision in the sky?
Well, when you launch your rocket, you want to make sure you have enough fuel. So they usually add in 2 or 3% extra just to be sure. And if you leave that last stage of the rocket in orbit, it can explode with the fuel inside, sending debris up into space and hitting other satellites. So about 20, 30 years ago, they decided that they were always going to get rid of the fuel before they burnt the last stage up in the atmosphere. So that's what you see. Things have to be just perfect, though. It has to be launched just around sunset for Ireland to see it. It has to fly over us, of course, as well. And the venting has to happen close to the time it flies over Ireland. So all those coincidences came together. There are loads of rocket launches every year, so you can't really predict these things. And we want anybody who saw it certainly to send us a report. Astronomy.ie is the website. You'll see the contact details there. Or if you've got a photograph, even better. We'd love to publish an Irish photograph.
That's why we don't have one. Yeah, we don't have one from this
particular. We actually might do. One of the people in Waterford did say they got photographs, and we've asked them to send them in. So we don't have them yet, but we're hoping.
Oh, do get in touch with us as well. Oliver@ortiz.ie.
We'll send them to the whole country.
Yeah, do. it was rocket fuel, Blue. Whose rocket was this?
It's a SpaceX rocket. SpaceX, Elon Musk's company, have been prolific in launches in the last year. I think they now hold the record. It's almost that most launches are SpaceX launches. And they launched an American military satellite. So it's highly classified. Really? They don't say anything about it. So all we know is a military satellite.
They weren't even admitting it was them. He's firing a lot of rockets into the air, Elon Musk.
Yeah, and it's becoming a bit of a nuisance, to be honest.
Astronomers.
I'm taking photographs of night sky now. I get all these streaks on the pictures, especially if it's close to sunset. It's almost becoming like plastic in the ocean. It's polluting space, and it might not just be that causing ruining pictures, but we think all these rocket launches could be affecting the upper atmosphere as well. And his plans ultimately are for about 100,000 satellites. There's never been that many satellites in space, just for the Starlink project alone, which is internet from space.
How many satellites are in the space right now?
Well, one that you can sort of see with the naked eye, there's about 1,000 of them, roughly speaking. So people see these things crossing the sky. And to be honest, you see more of them now, man-made satellites, than you do natural shooting stars or meteors, give them the proper name. So they are becoming vermin of the night sky. And Ireland's member of the European Southern Observatory, which is building telescopes of the order of €1 billion, including the world's biggest one, should be ready later this year. And they reckon now 30% of the time on that €1 billion telescope is going to be wasted, ruined, because of all these satellites. But not just the Elon Musk, but also Jeff Bezos, Blue Origin Company, is planning to do something similar, and so are some big consortia in the US. And there's no real regulation to stop them ruining in the night sky, which inspired a lot of young people to take up science careers, which is extremely important to Ireland, is where most of our revenues come from.
David Moore from Astronomy Ireland chatting to Oliver Callan today. Last December, the practice of dry stone wall construction became the fifth Irish cultural heritage practice to be recognised by UNESCO. The craft, which was practised in the Neolithic period, is still carried out today, as reporter Maura Fay found out on Today with Claire Byrne.
Hi, Maura.
Hi, Claire.
This is an unusual one. What have you been learning about dry stone wall construction?
Well, Claire, last Saturday on a cold, rainy morning, I joined a group of people who are learning about the craft at a workshop being run by the Dry Stone Wall Association of Ireland at the beautiful Mount Dalton estate just outside Mullingar. Now, the course is 2 days long and it's run with the support of the National Built Heritage Service. It's aimed at beginners and you basically learn how to build big sturdy walls without any mortar. As part of the course, the group were learning how to rebuild two sections of walls, both about between 8 to 10 metres long, which had been damaged by recent storms. One of the first people I met was the owner of the Mount Dalton estate, farmer Michael Gibson Brabazon. He became involved with the Dry Stone Wall Association when they were doing a bit of work on the neighbouring hill of Ishnach, a site where the Celtic festival of Bealtaine is famously celebrated. Michael told me a bit about the history of stone walls on the estate and the challenges in maintaining them.
My relation that inherited it, he would have done a lot of building of the walls, quite possibly the walls that we're repairing today. The maintaining them, it's like over the generations, it's changed. Back in my grandfather's time, there would have been a guy employed on the farm, or a man employed on the farm, and one of his predominant jobs would have been maintenance and repair of walls. Obviously, nowadays, that luxury is long since gone. And then, even when I was a youngster, two of the guys that used to work on the farm, at times they'd go, you know, spend a day or two, go off doing repairs of walls and that, amongst all other farming tasks. Whereas nowadays, labour on farms, like most farms, you know, there's less and less labour. For practically, like, as regards getting people, and then also the financial end of it as well. So with the Dry Stone Wall Association, they've run their own workshops, and it's a huge benefit. I like being able to facilitate it. Number one, it's a teaching exercise. It's to teach people, you know, the tradition or the skill of dry stone walling, which I think is hugely important, that more and more people know how to, with the skill of it. And it's not like just placing one stone on top of another and just kind of this kind of, there is a lot of kind of methodology to it, and it's slow and it takes time. You can't rush it. I'm by no means an expert at all. I'm far from it. But it is time consuming, and that's what the problem with, for trying to maintain them on farms, for the owners or people that work on those farms, it is labour intensive, and trying to keep on top of the walls is, it's an ongoing task, because as soon as you've repaired a wall, you can be damn sure within a few months or the following winter that you're going to have another breach or more breaches. So basically we're trying to get round, improve with the maintenance of the walls, and this is a way of doing it.
Yeah, it sounds like a never-ending cycle. That's Michael Gibson Brabazon there. So Maura, he mentioned building the dry stone wall. So how do you do it?
Well, as the name suggests, Claire, there is no cement and no mortar allowed when you're building these walls. So very eco-friendly. One of the instructors on the course is Fergus Packman, who's based in Connemara. He has 35 years of experience in dry stone wall construction. And I asked him exactly how do you do it?
Oh my goodness, you start at the bottom anyway, that's for sure. bit of patience.
Do you need tools? Like, I noticed that guys here are just wearing gloves.
No, you generally don't need many tools. I like to joke that I can scratch a living with one bad hammer.
And tell me about this wall that we're building here today. Can you describe the kind of shape of its construction?
I certainly can, yes. So this is a consumption wall used to sort of swallow up the dearth of stone that was coming off the land when they were tilling. So there's a lot of this small white stuff that was tilled, and we need to use it up somehow. So what they've done is they've built a wall of two skins of building stone filled up with all the rubble from the land, and there's beauty and function. Looks lovely and it's doing a great job.
This is quite labour intensive. Like, if you were doing this stretch of wall by yourself, how long would it take you?
Oh, it'd take me probably 3 days.
Wow. Yeah. So it's easier when you have a big group like this?
Ah, it is, yeah, many hands.
What are the common mistakes you see people making when they're building a dry stone wall? What can you do to prevent it falling down again?
Yeah, I think probably people are concentrate too much on what the face of the wall looks like rather than how the stones are laid with integrity. And I can understand how that can happen, but you have to build for strength first, beauty second, and that's the trick.
And when you're saying laying stones there with integrity, is it you talking about laying them so that they're balanced and flat?
Absolutely, yeah. You have to be flat. You have to be balanced. You see that they're all running in the way into the wall, so they're interlocking with the opposing face. You know, so the wall is an integral piece when all the stones are put together properly.
Do you think anyone can learn this skill?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, it's you've got to like to be outside. You're going to like to get stuck in. You've got to be a bit grounded, I think. There's not too much to it. Experience can make it a bit better looking, but I think the fundamentals are easy to pick up.
When this wall goes back up, how long should it last, provided there are no more storms?
Oh, yeah, I think we're good to go for a couple hundred years anyway.
It's like playing Jenga, is it?
It is, yeah.
Laying them in the right way. And it sounds like it's backbreaking work as well, is it, Maura?
It is, but it depends how heavy the stones are you're lifting. So most of the stones they were lifting now were reasonable. I wouldn't say they were anything above kind of 15 kg.
Yeah, but give it a few hours now and you'd feel it. How many people were there?
There were 10 men in total, Claire. Actually, one of the people told me running the course that it was the first time in their experience that there wasn't a mix of genders on the course. Some were farmers who'd dry stone walls on their land. Others were involved in the construction trade and wanted to learn a new skill. Here's what one of them told me about why they were taking part in the course.
My name is Cyril Higgins. I live up in the northwest Donegal. I'm originally a Mayo man, and I've always had an interest in dry stone and in the vernacular, as they call it. And so I'm retired now, and I do a small bit of farming. And I just find it fascinating that the stones that we are lifting today was lifted many hundreds of thousands of years ago. And, you know, it's part of our heritage and we should look after it and keep it right.
How are you finding the course so far? Is it very interesting?
Fascinating. An amazing mixture of people. It's our first morning out. The weather hasn't been too kind to us. But when you look across, you can see the improvement even in the last half hour. So the only way is up, as the saying goes. So here we are.
And even though you're retired, this is quite a labour-intensive activity. Yeah. I suppose it'll keep you going for a while longer.
Yeah. Well, I'm in a stage of my career now that we grew up in the 60s in rural Ireland, and the only thing we knew really was work, and we worked all the time, and so we never were afraid of work, and so it's just another occurrence, another day's activity. Good for the mental health, I think, as well. Really is exciting.
Yep, you'd have to have an appetite for work now for this. I mentioned there, Maura, that it's recognised by UNESCO. What does that mean? How significant is that?
So that's something I spoke to Ken Kern about. He's a trustee with the Dry Stone Wall Association, which he helped found in 2009. He explained to me how prevalent the craft is around Ireland.
Every county in Ireland has dry stone structures, dry stone walls. They're throughout the whole country. The history of it is very ancient here, since the Neolithic period, since people migrated onto Ireland from continental Europe. We've had dry stone structures as part of either farming or our monuments, or like the passage tombs in the Boyne Valley are dry stone construction. At one point there probably was 1 million kilometres of dry stone walls and ditches around the country. That figure has dropped significantly in the last 100 years. So I guess the likes of what we're doing here today, both teaching and repairing and maintaining walls, is important for us to try and push back against a little bit of that loss that we have. But we have a phenomenal amount of them all over the country. There's 600,000 kilometres of stone earthen banks and walls as part of boundary walls and field systems in Ireland.
This craft is now recognised by UNESCO, and that happened very recently. Can you tell me a little bit about the significance of it?
What it actually means is that it's one of only 5 cultural practices here, whereby the knowledge is considered part of our cultural heritage. And those other practices would be the likes of hurling, illan piping, illan pipe making, harping, and falconry. So it's an elite list that's included in. But I guess dry stone and the practice of dry stone is so integral as to part of our cultural identity, of who we are. If you consider about what we said about how long we've been practicing it for, it's the knowledge within our community of how to build the walls, and it's the bearers of that, so the people that build the walls and those that safeguard it, that has been added to the UNESCO inscription, which hopefully then means that as a culture and nationally that we support those practitioners, help them to keep the practice alive, whether that's through training or whether it's support to people who have have Voice and Walls on the land to help to maintain them and keep them.
Okay, you see, it's the building of the wall, that's grand. It's finding the stone. That's the person who's to go out and find the stones, Maura, that we feel sorry for this morning. What if people want to learn more about it, Maura? Where do they go?
So the association has a really good website, dwsai.com, and they also post actively on their Facebook page, and there's a lot of info there.
Maura Fay reporting on Today with Claire Byrne. Finally, Daffodil Day is this Friday, March the 28th, and it's the Irish Cancer Society's largest and most important campaign. And earlier, Ray Darcy was joined by Tara Doonan, Daffodil Day Ambassador 2025, who shared her story.
Tara, seeing as you're sitting in front of me, I'll start with you.
Sure.
So this is your first year.
Yeah.
So you have a big reason why you're doing it.
Yeah, I'm a breast cancer survivor myself, yeah. Diagnosed in summer of 2022, yeah, with breast cancer at the age of 26. Wow. Sorry, 36.
36.
If only.
But even then, like, that's very young, isn't it?
Ah, yeah, it is. Well, so I thought it was. But, you know, of course, when I got my diagnosis, everybody had a story for me of another young person with cancer, because it just doesn't seem to discriminate, you know, and it doesn't seem to be a disease of the elderly anymore, as I suppose naively, that's what I thought. When I found the lump, I thought that, you know, 55 was in my head for some reason, that once I approached 50s into 60s, I'd have to start being aware of cancer in general. So, yeah.
So when you noticed the lump, you were going, what, this is harmless?
Not initially, no. Like, I'd always heard the phrase, my blood ran cold, but I never really knew what it meant until that moment. And I found the lump. Initially, my mind immediately jumped to breast cancer. But like then very quickly, you know, more or less stopping such drama queen. Like,
all right.
calm down.
Catastrophizing.
Like, yeah, exactly. Like, you're not even 40. This has to be a cyst or hormonal or something like that. So I put it out of my mind, said that if it hadn't disappeared in a few days or weeks, I might get it checked out. And it hadn't. So I went to my local GPE, who also reassured me that she didn't think it was anything sinister. The word she used was fibrous, because the lump I had wasn't the pea-sized hard lump that I would have heard about in some campaigns. It was quite large and felt almost like a water balloon under the skin of my right breast. So again, totally reassured after that appointment, but she referred me on anyway to triple assessment clinic in a hospital in Dublin. So that's where I got the news that it was in fact cancer and not a cyst.
And as you went through the system and the various tests, you were still in disbelief, or were you?
Oh, God, yeah. So naive. So naive. I wasn't going to bring my husband, Kevin, with me. But I thought, we're going up to the big smoke, we may as well make a night of it and go out and book a nice hotel to celebrate, you know, what could have been. Because already that's where my head was at, that this is a cyst, it's nothing to worry about. So thankfully he was with me on the day. You know, I was in for mammograms. I hadn't been for mammogram before, and they put you in all these really awkward.
Yeah, it's uncomfortable,
positions.
I believe.
Yeah,
Jenny was telling me.
Right. Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of squeezing and pressing.
A lot of squeezing, a lot of pressing, a lot of different positions. Now, move here, move there. And, you know, you're naked from the waist up. And I was making jokes about, this feels like I'm in some sort of kinky Playboy magazine shoot or something.
Were they laughing?
I was getting nothing. So I thought, right, God, they're awful dry up here in Dublin. But little did I know that they could probably see it. Yeah. On the scans, do you know, they could see it. And I say they, because they actually brought in a second radiographer, which still didn't ring alarm bells in my head to read the scans. I was brought in and out twice and three times. Still just thought, maybe it's just difficult to get an image of it, you know. I don't know if it was denial or foolishness or naivety, but right up until in the office with the consultant at the end of probably 6, 7, 8 hours, right up until facing him, sitting down facing him, cancer did not enter my mind since that first time, we'll say, I found the lump.
And then we hear an awful lot about when it's said,
mm-hmm.
what happens?
Mm-hmm.
What was your experience?
It just felt like the whole world stopped spinning on its axis. Like, silence was kind of the main memory I have of that time. But very quickly, what has to be done? You know, okay, what do we do about this? And he talked, the surgeon talked through the treatment plan. But then it's when he said, and of course you'll want to find out if it has spread, that the penny really dropped as to how serious cancer can be and what it means. And that's when it was like the films or what you hear, like the room went into the distance. He went into the distance. I could hear his voice, but everything just slowed down. My life flashed before my eye. All the cliche things happened to me.
Yeah.
But I remember just saying to myself, snap out. You have to hear what he's saying. This is important. Come back into the room. And like mere, I'd say 2 seconds had passed. And that was that, you know, we're suspicious it's cancer. And I'm so grateful to how the consultant, told me the news, because I think he realised that I was just, it was the last thing on my mind. And we were still wearing the masks. And I just remember him, like, I felt like his eyes were just reaching into my soul to try to get the message to sink in. You know, Tara, you need to prepare yourself that the next time we're talking, you know, it's going to be about moving
treatment.
On treatment. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, because you have cancer. You need to prepare yourself. You have cancer.
Yeah. Yeah. You're here to tell your story.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to talk more about the wonderful help you got from the Irish Cancer Society.
Yeah.
Mary, in our Limerick studio, Mary, you've been helping out on Daffodil Day for how long?
I started about 25 years ago or so when I was teaching in County Carlo, and we used to do the Daffodil Day in school. And then when I relocated back to County Clare, I got involved with a wonderful team of ladies there who were working on Daffodil Day. And little did I think ever, you know, when I got involved at any time, that I would be benefiting directly from the services of the Cancer Society.
Yeah. Well, it affects so many people.
Yeah, 1 in 2 people,
yes,
apparently.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I visited you when?
2020. I noticed a blood show, and it was the beginning of COVID. So a lot of the medical, you know, services and tests were shut down at the time. So getting, you know, a diagnosis took a little bit of time. And I had a womb removed in August and followed by radiotherapy. And then the following summer, a cancer showed up in the bowel, and I had a bowel operation followed by chemotherapy. So 2 cancers within kind of a year and a half or so.
She's a poor woman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And now I'm cancer free, thank God.
Mary Woods. And before that, Tara Doonan on the Ray Darcy Show today, talking about Daffodil Day. And that's all we have time for on today's Playback Daily. So from me, Louise Herity, thanks for listening and take care.